content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Steve Lord from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to a half hour of captivating developments in science, medicine, technology, and the world around us, as reported in Discover, the magazine of science. Today's episode from the December 2017 issue of Discover features a short story on depression and three longer stories on gene editing, aspen trees, and Egyptian animal mummies. When depression treatment works. Monsoon rains have set off an explosive growth of greenery in front of Magdu Ferreira's house in the small village of Hassapur in central India. A 7-foot plant with leaves striped in red and yellow anchors it all, and seems to point to a large stone cross sitting atop a mossy pedestal where the garden meets a quiet, narrow road. This is the refuge of 66-year-old Ferreira, not her real name. It's the place she goes to relax. But about 3 years ago, not long after her husband died, not even the garden could soothe her. Ferreira didn't want to cook. She didn't want to eat. There was no concentration, she remembers. She stopped spending time with her daughter and granddaughter, who lived a short walk down the road. I was keeping myself apart. I was staying alone. She slept most of the day. Sleep, sleep, all the time. And most disturbingly, she thought about suicide. I was just thinking life is totally worthless. There wasn't much reason to live, she says now. I did not take any steps, but I used to get thoughts. Several months later, the depression and suicidal thoughts were gone. The disappearance started with a trip to the health center for her blood pressure and diabetes. As she was checking in, a healthcare worker came by. Had Ferreira lost interest in doing anything in the last couple of weeks? Yes. Was she feeling down, depressed, or hopeless? Yes, again. After a short chat with a counselor, Ferreira was told she had tension. People in the area don't have a single word for depression, and mental illness is considered serious and untreatable. Tension isn't stigmatizing, and it's something that can be dealt with. Her counselor asked if she wanted to be in a research study being conducted in several countries. I told her I wasn't educated, I don't understand, Ferreira says. The counselor reassured her. It was no problem. Ferreira figured she had nothing to lose. Sangath, a nearby non-profit group that works on mental health issues, sent Subhash Pednekar to visit. He'd had 3 weeks of training in how to help people get active and how to solve problems that can play a part in depression, like being in debt. In weekly visits over a couple of months, Pednekar gave Ferreira specific tasks to focus on: 2 hours of housework, then building up to 3, time in the garden, visits to her granddaughter. Ferreira agreed to be in a Sangath study called Premium that was evaluating an early version of a lay counselor program. Data from her treatment would become part of a published research report. A placebo group in the study received conventional care, a few words from the doctor, plus some educational material on depression. The results? 2 months after the last visit from a counselor, the remission rate was 46% in the treatment group and 29% in the placebo group. For Ferreira herself, within a few weeks of the counselor's first visit, she was back on track. These days, she's happy, and especially happy when her old counselor comes to visit. She spends time with her granddaughter, works in her garden, and laughs and smiles when she talks about her life. The CRISPR antidote. Scientists hacked the machinery of cellular warfare to splice genes. Now, they've found a way to guard against it, too. An arms race is playing out inside your body. It's part of an invisible war that's raged for billions of years. When viruses hunt and infect bacteria, the bacterial survivors store pieces of their vanquished foes, DNA snippets, within their genomes, so that next time they can detect and defend against the attack. In response, viruses evolve their own counterattack. The bacteria's natural defense system is called CRISPR-Cas9. And in 2012, biochemist Jennifer Doudna, together with French microbiologist Emmanuel Charpentier, upended genetics with an ingenious idea. What if scientists could exploit CRISPR as a gene-editing tool? Since then, Doudna and others have hacked these cellular weapons in an effort to treat diseases and create stronger crops. Now, scientists are attempting another task, avoiding unintended mutations resulting from their gene edits. To grasp the tool's precision, imagine the letters of a genome, G, A, T, C, typed into a stack of books dozens of stories high. A guide RNA shepherds Cas9, which acts like a pair of DNA scissors, to the right spot, where it zooms in on just 20 letters and lets scientists change a few. CRISPR-Cas9 lets you find the right spot, says Joseph Bondi-Denamy, a microbiologist at the University of California, San Francisco. That's a big deal. Indeed, a global gene editing revolution is underway. Lawyers battle over patent rights. CRISPR startups are selling stocks on the NASDAQ. And in a milestone this year, Oregon Health and Science University researchers used CRISPR to successfully correct heart disease-causing genes in human embryos. It was the first U.S. CRISPR experiment on humans. But despite its track record, sometimes CRISPR brings unintended consequences, gene edits in undesired locations. Scientists call these off-target effects. Cas9's scissors don't always stop once the targeted cuts are made. Sometimes the scissors will roam for another day or two, cutting other sites that resemble the target but aren't quite a perfect match. If left to their own devices over time, CRISPR proteins might have the ability to cause trouble, says Doudna, who is also a University of California, Berkeley professor. In May, a group of ophthalmologists and others sounded the alarm bells in a letter published in Nature Methods. The team used CRISPR to fix a blindness-causing gene in mice. But when they re-examined the mice, they found hundreds of unintended genetic mutations. Headlines about off-targets ensued, and CRISPR stocks tanked. Doudna challenges the group's methods and thinks that, in general, the off-target fear is overblown. Scientists knew about these mutations, and the technology is more than accurate enough for academic research purposes. The problems begin only as scientists move CRISPR into complex clinical trials. Bondi-Denamy, the USCF microbiologist, appears to have found a natural way to combat these off-target effects. His research focuses on the arms race between bacteria and viruses, and last year, Bondi-Denamy started testing out a hunch. If bacteria defend against viruses using CRISPR, he reasoned, then viruses likely have a response to counteract it. He was right. Viruses do produce anti-CRISPR proteins that grab Cas9 and impair its gene editing ability. He published his results in Cell in January 2017. This is basically an off switch, he says. By summer, Doudna, Bondi-Denamy, and their collaborators had used this viral counterpunch to reduce off-target effects. In Science Advances, the team detailed how they used CRISPR to make edits and then deployed anti-CRISPR to stop the Cas9 scissors from running amok. The technique could help CRISPR move from the lab toward more therapeutic applications, where absolute precision is required, Doudna says. Other teams are exploring different ways to avoid off-target effects, too. For example, the team that edited human embryos earlier this year saw no off-target effects, thanks to prep work aimed at keeping CRISPR on a shorter leash. However, this gene-editing antidote could have another important use. Security experts, including former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, worry that CRISPR makes things easier for would-be bioterrorists. Bondi-Denamy says if someone launched a CRISPR attack on humans or our crops, anti-CRISPR could work as an antidote. DARPA, the U.S. military research agency, liked the idea enough to give Dudna and Bandidinomi a grant to continue making Cas9 safer. While Bandidinomi doubts CRISPR will ever be deployed in a human battle, he can at least be confident in knowing anti-CRISPR has already proven itself in the cellular arms race. The life and death of Pando. Researchers have partially hidden Earth's largest life form behind a small protective fence. On a cold, sunny October day, I traveled with Paul Rogers, an ecologist at Utah State University, to see the largest known living organism on Earth. The creature resides in the high mountains of southern Utah on public land. It's a 106-acre aspen stand named Pando, literally, I spread in Latin. Linked by a single root system, Pando consists of tens of thousands of genetically identical trees cloned from a sprout that emerged after the last glaciation in southern Utah, roughly 13,000 years ago. At some point since then, we don't know exactly when, because we don't know how old Pando is, this enormous being germinated from a seed the size of a pepper grain. Pando is dying, and Rogers has been trying to figure out why. The 55-year-old has studied quaking aspen for more than two decades. Disease, blight, climate change, and wildfire suppression have all taken their toll on Pando, but the root cause of decline is a surprising one. Too many herbivores, namely mule deer. The deer feast on the aspen, literally eating away the young before they can mature. Pando is now made up almost solely of old and deteriorating trees. A whole society, this huge clone, and it's all senior citizens, Rogers says as we walk through the clone. There are no children, no young trees, no middle-aged. So what comes next? Where are the babies? It's a system out of whack. We wend toward an experimental section of the clone that has been fenced off from the hungry ungulates since 2013 and will remain fenced indefinitely. Funded by an alliance of nonprofit conservationists in cooperation with the U.S. Forest Service, scientists hope to see what happens when Pando is freed from the pressure of herbivores. Stop the herbivory, and this is what happens, Rogers says as he runs his fingers on a new aspen sprout. Safe behind the fencing, the year-old plant is slender and smooth, about as tall as an infant first learning to stand. There's been a remarkable return of the young. Pando is like any other aspen grove, except that it's the largest known to humans. With their glowing white bark and yellow autumn color, aspen forests are iconic in the American West. Aspen leaves move in a curious manner when touched by the wind, due to the way the leaf attaches to the stem. This produces the quaking light of the typical aspen forest, a romantic effect that gives the species its name. This feature also happens to benefit the understory. More light filters through the leaves to produce more diversity of grasses, mosses, and lichens. Aspens are also the region's single most biodiverse woodland ecosystem. Their bark is soft, offering easy habitat for scores of species of cavity-nesting birds. I spend several hours walking in the woods with Rogers as he recounts the importance of his favorite tree. He tells me the Ute Indian tribal legend about the branch scars that are common on aspen trunks and how they resemble eyes. The eyes watch humankind. They watch the young hunter in the forest to ensure he is respectful, reverent. His kill is observed, judged. The forest of eyes, the legend says, is one big eye. A breeze blows, and the trees that still wear their leaves, most have shed them by October, shake in the light of the sun. Rogers pauses. That light, that sound, registering the wind, he says. Walking into an aspen grove is a peculiar experience. It's a place of contemplation, and you begin to think, what's an individual? This whole forest is an individual, and the so-called individuals we see are separate trees that are one. We're not used to thinking about living beings in the way that Pando makes us think. Rogers says scientists have never found a clone even half the size of Pando, but no one's really gone looking. He sees the fencing as a proving ground for restoration of other clones across the West. Because over-browsing, he warns, is now afflicting hundreds of thousands of acres of aspen. Under federal law, state wildlife agencies have almost total control over the management of deer and elk populations on public lands, including the national forests. The agencies want to maximize revenue from hunting fees. Hence, they have overseen increases in ungulates, including mule deer and elk, the two most sought-after species for trophy and meat hunters. The agencies could manage for lower populations, but this runs against sustained yield, which means sustained income for the agencies over time. Elk populations across the West are higher than at any time in recorded history. In Utah, where there were few elk prior to European settlement, the introduced population tops 77,000. The current population estimate of deer in Utah is well over 300,000. States manage wildlife, particularly large game species, under an agricultural model, as a crop, Rogers says. This does not always track well for long-term forest resilience. Elk today are frequenting habitat where they never existed, like on desert plateaus. It's extremely problematic for the ecosystems that never evolved with that kind of browsing pressure. Justin Shannon, the Big Game Program Coordinator at the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources, disagrees with this claim of overabundance. Deer and elk populations in Utah are below the statewide management objectives, and the elk population in Utah has decreased 3 years in a row, Shannon said in an email. Elk browsing may be more harmful to aspen than deer because of their large appetites. In many areas of the West, aspen is doomed unless something is done to control abundant elk that eat the young aspen sprouts, says Bill Ripple, an ecologist at Oregon State University who has pioneered the study of herbivory in ecosystems. Richard Lindroth, an entomologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, agrees. He says that if we don't reduce the impact of ungulates on aspen, it will inevitably lead to losing many of these trees across the West. One answer to over-browsing is to let nature go to work on the landscape, with more predators eating more ungulates. In a nature-predator-prey cycle, cougars and wolves generally keep deer and elk populations in check, as has happened in many of the West's national parks. And predators, especially pack hunters like wolves, create an ecology of fear, affecting ungulate behavior in ways that ultimately benefit aspen. Constantly looking over their shoulders and forced to keep on the move, elk don't linger in the same feeding areas. This distributes the damage from their browsing, and aspen are better able to regenerate. A small number of wolves now roam in New Mexico and Arizona, but wolves were extirpated from Utah at the behest of powerful ranching interests more than a century ago. When I asked the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources about the possibility of a wolf reintroduction into the state, a spokesman there told me, Utah has no intention of reintroducing wolves. For now, Pando will have to keep hiding behind its protective fencing. The animal mummy business, a museum's forgotten cache of preserved creatures, shines a light on an ancient, possibly unethical, practice. When tourists visited Egypt in the late 19th century, they often came home carrying animal mummies. The ancient creatures were considered excellent souvenirs, compactly embodying the exotic rituals of an ancient society. The mummies were also abundant. One cemetery in Saqqara contained 7 million embalmed dogs. Another held 4 million mummified ibises. Some of the souvenirs were subsequently unwrapped to see what was inside. Others were bequeathed to museums, where they were politely received and shuffled into basements. That's where a curatorial assistant at the Brooklyn Museum found 30 uncatalogued animal mummies in 2009, neatly shelved in a storage vault. Times had changed since they were set aside in the 1930s and 40s. Early on, museums were specifically interested in displaying luxurious objects, says associate curator Yekaterina Barbash. Now more and more curators are interested in displaying the real life of ancient Egyptians. The Brooklyn mummies were neither rare nor glamorous. On the contrary, as the most commonplace artifacts of ancient Egypt, they clearly relate to everyday cultural practices. And yet, they're also very peculiar, only slightly better understood today than they were by 19th century tourists. Textual evidence shows that Egyptians perceived animals in ways that were baffling, even to their contemporaries. Associating dogs and ibises with deities, Egyptians elicited scorn from neighboring Jewish and Roman authorities. Unraveling the meaning of the mummies, therefore, has the potential to reveal some of the deepest mysteries of a mysterious people. The Brooklyn Museum's animal mummies, which are on view through January 21st, have become key figures in a multi-year investigation involving Egyptologists, conservators, and even a veterinary radiologist. Egypt's animal cults date back to the beginning of its civilization. "We find evidence in the very oldest archaeological sites," says Barbish. Initially, the cults tended to focus on specific individual animals with sacred markings, seen as incarnations of gods. The most celebrated of these, venerated as early as 3000 BC, was the Apis bull, embodiment of god Ptah. Coddled during life, the creature was mummified and buried with great ceremony after it died a natural death. After the burial, priests sought another bull with identical patterning. Animals also played an important role in Egyptian iconography. Gods were frequently portrayed as animal-human hybrids. For instance, the god of writing, Thoth, was sometimes shown with the body of a man and head of an ibis. The origin of this practice remains as elusive as the rise of those animal cults, but Barbash suspects it may relate to the relative ease of life in the lush Nile Valley, where people had the time to observe animal behavior and associate divine attributes with the traits of bulls and ibises. Yet all these activities seem humdrum compared with what happened during the Third Intermediate Period, from approximately 1075 to 656 BC. With startling suddenness, mummification went mainstream. Tens of millions of embalmed animals were deposited in at least 31 cemeteries throughout Egypt. One cat repository, found by farmers in 1888, was reported to have a stratum thicker than most coal seams, 10 to 20 cats deep. Struggling to explain the phenomenon, some scholars have described the mummies as votive offerings, akin to candles in Catholic churches. At the Brooklyn Museum, a more beguiling explanation is emerging. "The Egyptians believed animals had souls," asserts Edward Bleiberg, the museum's head curator of Egyptology. "Like the soul of a human, the animal's soul, or ba, was capable of posthumous travel and communication, and the relationship of the animal to a particular deity allowed its soul to address the god directly, as long as its body was properly mummified." Bleiberg gleaned this information from ancient texts. Perhaps more interesting is what he found in letters buried within a few of the mummies. Their writers implored the gods to help them with personal troubles and disputes at work, offering donations to their respective temples in exchange. "It was very transactional," he says, noting that this divine deal-making may have become particularly important in the Third Intermediate Period as the power of the central government disintegrated. "People were looking for other ways of solving their problems," he says. "The mummies were dispatched as messengers to the gods. And in the vast majority of cases where letters are not found," Bleiberg surmises that the messages were delivered orally. Given the complexities of mummification and the proximity of animal catacombs to temples, the practice was clearly administered by the priesthood, which seems to have treated it as a business. Preparations range from simple linen wrappings to fancy coffins shaped to evoke the animal inside, a divine messenger for every price point. But observation of the artifacts and textual evidence can reveal only so much. Egyptologists still want to understand how priests supplied such heavy demand, and whether they resorted to fraud. On June 17, 2011, the animal mummies in the Brooklyn Museum took a trip across the Brooklyn Bridge to the Animal Medical Center in New York. Over the course of 7 hours, animal radiologist Anthony Fischetti subjected them to high doses of radiation in the hospital's CT scanner. "It was very different from my usual work," he says. "It didn't require any sedation." At the request of Liburg and Barbash, Fischetti identified the creatures inside, ibises and cats and shrews and snakes, and also noted details such as their age and physical condition. He found that many were young and had fractured necks or trauma administered by blunt instruments. These results lend weight to the researchers' conjecture that priests resorted to industrial-scale farming and slaughter to harvest the legions of future mummies. Some scans also showed incomplete mummies, or even empty wrappings, supporting ancient accusations, preserved in the Egyptian equivalent of court documents, that the priests were cheating their customers, perhaps because they couldn't keep up with people's divine communication needs. However, other scans suggested there may be more to the story. Partial animals are often found in elaborate packages paid for by wealthy patrons who could probably afford a whole cadaver, especially since there are plenty of cheaper examples containing complete bodies. And follow-up scans, using the American Museum of Natural History's more powerful CT machine, have shown that some wrappings enclose as many as 20 tightly packed shrews, hardly a way for priests to economize. These permutations on the mummy formula may reveal nuances in religious practice or regional differences in rituals. They might even end up elucidating how consistent beliefs were across space and time. "I think right now we're working at a very high level of generalization," says Blyberg. "The millions of preserved animal mummies in collections worldwide provide a uniquely large sample size for further study. We're talking about really big data here, especially for Egyptology, where we are quite often content to generalize from a very few cases," he says. "Here we have a real opportunity to generalize from a very large number of cases. The mummified messengers from ancient Egypt are plentiful and ready to communicate with us. We just need to unpack their carefully preserved messages." "150 years of studying this, and we still haven't figured it out. There will be plenty for the next generation to chew on," so wrote paleogeneticist Johannes Kraus, co-author of a July study in Nature Communications that found modern humans interbred with Neanderthals 220,000 to 470,000 years ago, more than 100,000 years earlier than previous studies had suggested. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover, the Magazine of Science. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. Till then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.